This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
How do imperial legacies shape present-day academia knowledge production? How are the colonial pasts and obligations arising from it debated today? What role do they play in political relations within Europe and in Europe's relations with the rest of the world? These are some of the questions we seek to address in our 8-lecture series in cooperation with the Fritz Thyssen Foundation on science, knowledge, and the legacy of empire. This podcast episode is a recording of the 3rd lecture of the series, given by Dhruv Rayner, recently retired professor at JNU New Delhi, under the title After-Colonial Forms of Knowledge and Post-Colonial Technoscience, Revisiting the Historiography of Techniques and Technology. Dhruv Rayner's lecture explores the conceptual challenges of developing a comprehensive historiography of techniques and technology in a global context. The encounter between Europe and Asia in the 18th and 19th centuries produced several discourses on the non-Western, non-European worlds that played a formative role in the crystallization of the social science disciplines. Late 20th century scholarship has indicated that there is no purely European discourse on India and its knowledge forms. Nevertheless, despite important differences, there is a family resemblance in the description, naming, and troping of colonial forms of knowledge. On the other hand, the history of technology is framed by certain conceptual distinctions and ideological paradigms that distinguish techniques from technology as much in Europe as elsewhere. Interrogating the distinction between the history of techniques and technology opens up other ways of historicizing their evolution in South Asia and the Global South.
Thank you for a very generous introduction. I thank the German Historical Institute and the Thyssen Foundation for this invitation, and the staff of the German Historical Institute for making this trip possible. It is indeed an honor to be invited to speak here. My talk today will have 3 parts. The first part will be a discussion on the history of technology and the history of techniques. The second part would be a review of a really long paper two students of mine and I wrote up on the historiography of technology in South Asia. So I'll try to summarize the main argument. And the third part is life after empire. What does it mean? Now, the history of science and techniques of the non-Western world has undergone a major revision and several historiographic revisions over the last couple of decades. From the intense debates on colonial forms of knowledge, like Bernard Cohen and others, followed by the eruption of post-colonial theory and history of sciences in the 1980s, to questions concerning the history of technology in these very regions, the concept of post-colonial technoscience provided a new way of destabilizing prevalent histories of science and technology in South Asia and regions of the global South at large. So it's a larger movement. These developments occurred along several axes of social theory, the most salient of which followed in the wake of what is referred to as the social turn in science studies, however broadly construed in the social studies of science and of the social studies of science in context. The discourse on different ways of knowing and their marginalization within histories of knowledge and postcolonial science studies drew on multiple sources extending from the work of Edward Said and Gramsci to the work of scholars such as Arturo Escobar, Ashish Nandi, eco-feminists such as Vandana Shiva, and many others. Post-colonial science came to refer to the historical interrogation of a European colonialism and how that circumstance shaped and continues to shape the relationship between West and non-West after the passing of colonialism. This required describing the continuing process of resistance and reconstruction of this process from the perspective of, within quotes, the non-West. Like other critical theories that arose to prominence in and around the time, the 1980s was a great period that way, there was thus an engagement with the experience of oppression, resistance, race, gender, representation, difference, as manifest, as Sandra Harding says, in Western discourses of history, philosophy, and linguistics. More specifically, within the realm of social theory, central concepts and associated theories of modernity and development were up for revision. As far as post-colonial science studies were concerned, the integrity of the idea of Western sciences and the associated diffusionist premises were rejected by the newer histories and constructivist ideas of the sciences. Gradually, as scholarship crystallized around the Science and Empires research program in France, the study of non-Western knowledge systems from a diversity of sources and perspectives sought to extend the idea of political justice into the realm of knowledge. In South Asia, post-colonial theory provided a frame for revisioning the exchange of scientific knowledge. The concern with justice within the politics of knowledge became an increasingly important one as the discipline of history took a turn towards global, transcultural, and transnational history. In 2007, the sociologist Shiv Vishwanathan, who had been exploring the idea of cognitive justice since 1996, gave it a programmatic form, specifying clearly what the imperatives of cognitive justice were, commencing with the recognition of the right of different forms of knowledge to coexist. The question was not just one of allowing for or tolerating a plurality of knowledge forms, but to mandate the active recognition of the need for diversity. These knowledge forms present themselves as different ways of knowing, but in an institutional context, it is essential to recognize that these are also forms of life. For these knowledge forms to evolve and perhaps also to flourish, it is essential to see them as enmeshed, embedded relationally within an ecology of knowledge, knowledges. However, there is a cognate version of the concept proposed in Buaventura de Sousa Santos's Epistemologies of the South. While the former conception is paradigmatic, we need to specify a way of methodologically implementing it in concrete historical situations or develop an appropriate hermeneutic. For Vishwanathan, the realization of cognitive justice requires the invention of a democratic imagination. Santos's notion is also inspired by the commitment to social justice as the outcome of the achievement of global cognitive justice. This is the first sense in which the two notions overlap. Looked at from the perspective of an emancipatory politics, there is the need to reckon that transformations in the world may follow grammars and scripts other than those developed by Western-centric critical theory. In other words, neither the scripts of emancipation nor the theory of emancipation have an aura of universality, although the aspiration itself may certainly be so. This diversity in the script and in theory is valorized as a resource. Santos argues that in the contemporary world, the adequate recognition of injustice and the possible overcoming of oppression can only be achieved by means of an epistemological break. Today, I would like to discuss how these concerns play out in the history of technology and techniques, especially when discussing the history of techniques over the last 200 years. This itself gives us an idea of how a field of investigation is constantly reimagined, as it undergoes a complicated process of internal transformation, conceptual and theoretical revision, as a product of the interplay between bodies of knowledge, academic communities, and the wider socio-political context that some like to refer to as the social imaginaries associated with the field. Towards the end of the 1990s, we witnessed the ascent of amorphous developments in global history, transnational history, transcultural history, etc. With the global turn, we did not overcome all the problems that were hitherto encountered. But some distance had been traversed, and as the philosopher of mathematics or science, Imre Lakatos, would put it, we know the negative heuristic, where not to go, and which paths not to follow, and we must continue to make our own mistakes. My colleague Sonia Brinjas from the Max Planck Institute in Berlin edited a book to which we all contributed, How Not to Write the History of Science. As happens with the history of science, so too has the history of technology and techniques undergone change. The question of the modernity of technology distinguishes it in some way from its predecessor, namely techniques. All right, that's in the technological discourse. Leo Marx once pointed out that technology was possibly the truly distinctive feature of modernity. But social theorists have since been working with more encompassing ideas of multiple modernities, and those ideas were still around when Leo Marx was writing. Rather than see technology and society as distinguishable domains of human culture, or as posthumanism does, as entirely indistinguishable, it does make sense to consider a middle ground where they are considered partly overlapping socio-technical systems wherein the content and the boundaries are best left ill-defined. Beyond the distinction between a technology and society are two master narratives that frame writing about technology, both in historical and contemporary contexts. In either case, what may be heuristically designated as technological determinism or social determinism. As Latour puts it, technological determinism would be guns kill people, social determinism would be people kill people, not guns. Now, dystopian and utopian ideas of technology can, in a way, be traced back to these ways of framing. On what grounds do we link technology and modernity? Does it derive from its dependence and contribution to scientific inquiry, while recognizing that the focus of scientific inquiry is the natural world, and that of technological development is the rapidly changing material and organizational world of our design? Though technology did not independently set the momentum of social change, but over history, the cumulative and irreversible process of improvisation resulted in what McAdams calls regular waves of change. These waves have become more or less continuous over time. Despite the optimism that Vannevar Bush conveyed through his opus, Science, the Endless Frontier, the Bible of Science Policy after the Second World War, more or less, from the Brave New World of the 1930s to Orwell's 1984, a wave of scientism constantly shadowed the trail of inventions that followed in rapid succession. While it was understood that science had managed, to the extent possible, to acquire power over nature, real power, and one really marvels at Orwell's prophecy, real power was that which was exercised over the body and mind. Right, intimations of biopolitics and psychopolitics. Science and technology were merely instruments designed to achieve these ends. Underlying this wave of anti-scientism was the lament that things could have been different. All right, this is the constructive hypothesis that Hacking talks about. The question is, how do we understand technology, the goal end? For not only have technologies served as the tools of empire, they have done so as instruments of coercion, exploitation, and surveillance more or less everywhere. But the growth of technological systems has been socially justified by the possibly well-founded faith that on the whole, humanity has benefited in large measure from its development. But here too, when we turn to the historical writing on technology over the last 100 years, the accounts are quite checkered, and at no point has one imaginary, the dystopian or the utopian one, totally overwhelmed the others. In a recently completed project of the CNRS, Guillaume Tarnino, Lilian Hilaire Perez, and Jerome Lamy, in an enviable volume called The Global History of Techniques, all right, set out on a different kind of academic endeavor with other contributors, namely to produce, well, a global history of techniques, involving studies of technology seen as techniques on a global scale, chronicling the regional historiographies and the meaning societies accorded to technical activities. The use of the term techniques rather than technology is a strategy for destabilizing the history of technology, wherein the term technology is applied ubiquitously to denote advanced technological production of industrial societies, while technique has an ambiguous meaning and is employed polysemously. In this earlier understanding, technology is characterized as applied science that works towards the industrial operation of transforming materials into products, while the term in the reflexive sense used by social sciences, used by anthropologists and ethnographers to refer to it as a human science. Thus, technology frequently refers to Western techniques arising from the application of science that led to the economic and political expansion of Europe. In this sense, technology fails to capture techniques outside the scientific field over centuries and many regions of the world. This generates a sequence of historical moves from those working on regions outside Europe. In the first instance, this way of framing techniques creates a myth of a technological vacuum in places and time periods, and historians working in other regions then have to take recourse to terms like useful and reliable knowledge or useful knowledge in their accounts of technical practices, while others seek out words in the language of non-Western cultures to produce other narratives. Furthermore, the social sciences have contributed to the historiography of techniques without reducing techniques to efficiency by extending the term to activities and know-how that do not involve tools. In conformity with the modern use of the term techniques inspired by Marcel Mauss, and this is the work that Hilaire Perez and Carnino and Lamy set out to do, they see technical action as a social fact connected to human activities and interests. These cognitive movements consider technology as a human science in order to place technology back at the heart of intellectual history, as different from those who see it as instrumentation, industrial science, science in the frame of productivism, etc. The moral of the story is that the current history of technology, framed by the ideas of growth, progress, and innovation, acquires critical scrutiny in order to reveal the mode of existence of technical objects. In his marvelous book, The Shock of the Old, Edgerton suggests that we study, over here I quote, all places that use technology, both just the small number of places where inventions and innovation is concentrated, the history of technology should engage with all the world's population, which is mostly poor, non-white, and half female. In order to do so, he elaborates that we look at the end use of technology and not just where it was invented. At this point, the global history of techniques overlaps with some of the tenets of post-colonial theory of science and technology. I come to the second part of the talk now. As has been well documented, the modern history of science, as different from the history of modern science in India, was inaugurated by the British Orientalists in the last decades of the 18th century and was subsequently pursued by German and French scholars, followed by Indians who jumped into the field in the last quarter of the 19th century. On the other hand, East India Company officials, followed by British colonial officials in the late 18th and the first half of the 19th century, were positively captivated by the diversity, competence, and technical heritage of the subcontinent. The travelogue of the French astronomer Guillaume Legentil towards the end of the 18th century, his book called Voyage dans la mer de l'Inde, marvels at the speeds of the local caravels operating between the South China Sea and India's coastline. In fact, this gaze was quite in contrast with the Orientalist account of the sciences of India, at least accounts as they began to appear in the second half of the 19th century. But the question concerning technology was possibly raised in attempts to understand the role of technology in India's colonization and to understand the causes of India's economic and industrial backwardness and the West political ascendancy. In global terms, a whole new vocabulary entered the languages of the world that included terms like radio and automobile and aviator, while older terms acquired different meanings. From the Americas to India and beyond, the last decades of the 19th century was witness to the flood tide of railroad building, as the railways transported both materials and millions of humans across large distances, traveling in many directions. The movement of people was accompanied by enhanced communication, by radio, telegraph, and the new technologies. Marconi himself marveled. The electric waves went out into space unimpeded by the curvature of the Earth, and that people would soon be exchanging messages from the Atlantic to the furthermost ends of the Earth. But it was only in the 20th century that questions concerning technology and society in India began to be raised within disciplinary academic communities, though not by historians of technology proper, largely economic historians. Studies on the history of technology sought to situate the place and role of technology in the colonial economy and the processes of modernization and industrialization. The divide between the technological history of techniques and technology and the socio-economic dimensions of technological change were manifest in the publications appearing, on the one hand, in the Indian Journal of History of Science, which was a technological history of technology, and the Indian Economic and Social History of Review that published papers on the socio-economic dimensions of all technology. The minimalist agenda of the history of technology could be to study the nature and rate of technological change, the minimalist, and the identification of factors governing the rate of change. In the latter case, the history of technology becomes an interdisciplinary field intersecting with several of the social sciences and environmental science. In a recent paper, my former student Om Prasad, Noyini Sarma and I argue that these histories of techniques or technology in South Asia can be slotted into three broad historiographic moments or movements, with an overlap of which I shall try to offer as brief a summary as possible. The first of these movements is preoccupied with technology as it relates to processes of colonization and modernization. With the anchoring of a new technological regime and technological systems in India from the beginning of the 19th century, the title of two books by Daniel Hedrick, namely The Tools of Empire and Tentacles of Progress, ground the coordinates of this frame. A modern technology in the hands of colonial rulers became an instrument for the extension and consolidation of British rule in India. Hedrick's first book, in fact, synthesizes and develops a perspective about technology and imperialism that was developing through the 1960s and 1970s, pointing out how changes in the motives and means of technological intervention helped imperial powers consolidate their hold over the colonies in three phases of colonial expansion, namely penetration, conquest, and consolidation. These technological regimes he categorizes as the tools of penetration, the steamboat, and meaning, tools of conquest, guns, and most importantly, communication technologies. The work is of a comparative nature, discussing Africa and contrast the processes with what happens in India. At the same time, technology was also the agent for the transformation of a traditional society into a modern one. While East India Company officials and then colonial officials focused on the consolidation of their power in India, the technical innovations introduced generated interest among the Indians themselves. The British colonial regime invested enormously in communication techniques and networks in the 19th century to bind their colonies into a cohesive empire. The expansion of communication technologies also played a decisive role in the emergence of nationalist sentiments among the natives by enabling a more regular flow and exchange of information and people across the country and across colonies. However, with a global turn in the history of technology, another perspective began to emerge in the first decades of the 21st century, which did not refute the historiography just mentioned, but examined the process of drawing new nations and communities into a web of communication. This is the work of Amelia Bonilla at Manchester. One of the features of the historiography of this period is that in the literature of the time, modern science and technology is presented as a singular frame. In other words, modern science and technology were seen as components of a unitary system, when the techniques of the region themselves were compared to industrial technology, the perspective begins to diversify. In the early decades of the 20th century, in the Swadeshi movement in Bengal and the rise of Gandhian thought, a critique of industrial civilization and the homogenization of the industrial product began to be articulated. In the West, too, scholars such as Thorstein Veblen, sociologist, economist, wherever you want to put him, cautioned that machines had pervaded modern life in a way that erased anthropomorphic habits of thought, oblivious to questions of good and evil, and that laws of its functioning were based purely on material causation. So what I could like to add to what we did not say in our earlier paper is that while it may be true across the late 19th and early 20th century that there was a shared techno-optimism or techno-evangelism, at the same time there were similar ideas relating to the anxieties and fears that the newly emergent technologies were generating. The second move characteristically commences in the era of what you could call political decolonization. All right, I mean, I think one can identify four moments of decolonization, but we'll talk about that if need be. So political decolonization. During the commencement of this phase, technology was seen as ideologically neutral and value-free. This was a constituent element of the Cold War ideology of science. The economic theories of Kondratiev and Rostow's input-output growth models dominated the unconscious of science and technology in the developed and decolonizing worlds of the 1950s and 1960s. The paradigms of modernization and development theory were challenged by the failure of technology and development to deliver on their promise by the end of the 1960s and early 1970s. The introduction of modern technological systems and the delayed industrialization of former colonial nations demonstrated the failure of technology transfer models to reproduce the European economic miracle in these very societies and nations. The failure led to the recognition of the social and cultural life of technology. This recognition was concurrent with the ascent in studies of the social construction of technology in the Northern Academy. This movement corresponded in India with the beginning of the postmodern hyphen postcolonial turn, as modern technological systems came to be seen as regimes for the domination of former colonial nations by the West. Modern science and technology became, in the writings of Vandana Shiva, an exploitative patriarchal system for the economic exploitation of former colonial nations and the destruction of its ecological and natural resources. Thus, so-called Western ideas of technology and culture and its Eurocentric assumptions were up for interrogation. Abandoning the frame of technological neutrality, attention was turning to other ways of knowing, what Sandra Harding calls OKS, other knowledge systems. And the semantic field included terms like indigenous techniques, traditional techniques, alternate technologies, drawing upon local technological knowledge that had been passed on over centuries, like genetic material or memes, and ways of engaging with them could be developed. The refer to crisis in development of the 70s and the expanding awareness of negative externalities of industrial expansion and consumerism turned the focus upon the environmental degradation and the marginalization of indigenous communities in the developmental process. Gandhi's Hind Swaraj, which was a concerted critique of late 19th and early 20th century industrialism, was reread by neo-Gandhians in the 1970s, who articulated a civilizational critique of Western technology. Retrospectively seen, these framings were in terms of East and West, a sort of post-colonial reconfiguration of an older binary of the colonizer and the colonized. Within the constructivist turn, the earlier critiques or rejection of technology in the 1990s began to be seen as part of the response of cultural assimilation of technology. Technology became an important object of investigation in environmental history, and the negative social and ecological impact of the Green Revolution began to show up in these critiques and critical science studies. These created a space for the recovery of lost histories of technical practices and more substantial engagement with the nature of the relationship between science and technology and modern technological life. Thirdly, by the 1980s, Roy MacLeod and a number of other scholars had revealed that as the laboratory of the colonial project, scientific and technological experiments, local knowledge and practices played a significant role in reconstituting the identity and the place of modern technology. So in other words, this was the argument of how the empire strikes back. While the demand for agricultural production picked up in the last decade of the 20th century, it was left to a German agronomist, Volker, to point out that it would be disastrous to dismiss local knowledges about agricultural practices, crops and soils available in India that had evolved over the centuries and had been validated over historical time and was dynamically changing. Education was a domain wherein the demands for naturalization were the most pressing. The professionalization and expansion of the community of engineers was accelerated by the process of industrialization and indigenization, and during the freedom struggle and after was shaped by the political project of nation building premised on scientific and technological self-reliance. The third movement is framed by the idea of global technoscience. By the early 1980s, India had emerged as a player in the global world of technology, having established credible nuclear and space research program capabilities and of installing its own version of the supercomputer. The development of research facilities with an ample resource base in advanced institutes of scientific and technological research distributed globally, it joined the genetic and information technology revolution and created its very own Silicon Valley in a city I used to know as Bangalore. Breaking with the linear theory of technological evolution and with linear historical narrative, now scholars began to examine a web of connected histories, intersecting timelines and multiple rhythms of technological development. Taking a cue from postcolonial studies, Warwick Anderson proposed that the concept of postcolonial technoscience in science studies played the role of destabilizing received framings and concepts of the history of technology, bringing in more heterogeneous sources and puncturing universalist claims. Furthermore, this required that the metropole and the colony, the center and the periphery, were to be examined within the same analytical frame in order to overturn conventional accounts of Western technoscience. This destabilization is concurrent with the decline of the nation-state as a unit for study, which results in the recognition of the proliferation of hybrid identities and the imperative adoption of interdisciplinary and multi-sided studies of technoscience. At the same time, postcolonial theory and technology as a cognitive movement rendered porous the boundaries between East and West, the modern and the so-called traditional. The porosity was premised on multidirectional knowledge flows, thereby not just highlighting the transformation of local knowledges by the so-called global, but the reconstitution of the global in interaction with the local itself. Since the 1980s, the histories of space and nuclear energy research programs have begun to be written. But the historiography of these technologies and the associated technosciences, for strategic reasons, has been hedged within national histories of technological development. While technologies, technological systems and practices have been mobile and in circulation globally, the histories that were written are splintered between the poles of international collaboration and indigenization and competition. But even so, despite the fact that historians of technology proper have still to enter the domain, the flavor of international collaboration is difficult to miss. While on specific technologies, there have been embargoes that have in turn compelled indigenization. But in the domain of space technology, India seemed to have benefited from the relatively neutral stance during the Cold War. But the backdrop of the Cold War was the context for the politicization of nuclear and space technologies. This provided a fertile ground for scholars from international politics to jump into the field. A pressing complaint of technologists who are also consumers of this history is that the textual focus of these studies overrides the concerns with technical practices and material culture. So I come to the last part, after empire. We now turn to reflect briefly upon the forces at work in the post-hyphenated colonial era, those that survived and those that were part of the changing context of science, society, and the state. What is the law of the resolution of forces forgive me for speaking as a former physicist, that will enable us to understand the relationship between science, technology, and the state after the Second World War and the passing of colonialism. Thus far, what we seem to have done is to discuss the changing landscape of the history of science and technology, and followed by a discussion of the changing imaginaries and historiography of technology in South Asia. From the beginning of the 20th century, the process of disciplinary institutionalization, the emergence of scientific societies and professional associations began to transform the knowledge production game. Despite colonial rule, academics and researchers began to build collegial and collaborative ties across countries, crisscrossing borders. By the time World War II ended, one could certainly speak of a global system of scientific and technological investigation and production, no matter how differentiated and marked by the legacies of colonial rule and imperialism. After the atomic bombs had been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Oppenheimer and his colleagues wondered about the kind of science they had produced, wherein the existence of science itself was threatened, and so was the value of science. It is indeed an important matter to consider how the histories of science of the next 50 years will be written. Immediately after World War II. But within a global perspective, scientific internationalism provided a scaffolding and ideology that enabled the circulation of knowledge across more or less isomorphic institutional forms and national contexts. Many Indian scientists at the time, and I'm talking from the 1930s onwards, were part of these networks of scientists, and these networks included Popular Front organizations that cropped up between the wars. Popular Front organizations of scientists. Immediately after the end of the Second World War, UNESCO became the locus for forging collaborative ties and projects. One of the objectives UNESCO set itself was not to intervene in the bright zone, a policy that was instrumentalized through what was referred to as the peripheral principle. Through the 1950s and much of the 1960s, UNESCO played an active role in promoting scientific programs in the developing world. Even during the Cold War, and I'm told there are different versions of the Cold War, so I'm talking about Cold War 1.0 and not Cold War 2.0 or 2.1, all right? It effectively ensured that scientific communication was not disrupted across the divide that the Cold War had instituted. And thus, while internationalism and the post-League of Nations Institute, such as UNESCO, provided a programmatic framework for a technological leveling and scientific collaboration, the modes of collaboration had shifted from what you might call autotelic, that is, collaboration instituted by scientists at an individual level, to heterotelic, where now collaboration was instituted through government or bilateral programs between governments. So after the war, we have more of what you might call heterotelic collaboration. In any case, during the Cold War, as the world was torn between the promise of atomic energy and its destructive possibilities, many thinkers deliberated upon the need of a political instrument as a way out that would evade the structures of totalitarianism and world government. So basically what I want to talk about are three forces at work here. Three movements, processes at work here: decolonization, the massification of the university, and the Cold War, that in a way globally structure how scientific institutions will evolve. The end of the Second World War, as Wallerstein argues, was witness to myriad changes in the global regimes of power, one major one being marked by the shift from Pax Britannica to Pax Americana. The consequences of this process for the world of science and technology was manifest in what John Creek calls the Americanization of higher education. One of the most significant aspects of which was the institutionalization of something called engineering science. In engineering schools across the world, the American universities that transformed engineering into a science by dovetailing engineering practice with the application of the sciences. Another inventor, Herbert Hoover, lamented that the European universities took a long time acknowledging that engineering was an applied science. As Herbert Hoover once remarked, engineering science was virtually a creation of the American university. Already by the 1940s, as Sabali's research studies shows, Indian students began
shifting their destinations in large numbers from England to American universities, particularly from the early 1940s onwards. And I have interviewed some of these people who made these changes. Now, America became the preferred destination. Thus, by 1945, as Ross Bassett's book called The Technological Indian remarks, the climate had become ripe enough in India to begin planning for the creation of an MIT type of institution in the country. In the early 1950s, simultaneously, the decade of decolonization, the massification of the university, and the buildup of the Cold War 1.0, the government of India sought to build its first generation IITs. The state was at the time serious about non-alignment, just when the build-up to the Cold War was dividing up the globe into different camps. India had initially approached the USA for help to build its version of an MIT. But on the latter's own assessment, it was felt that this would have been a premature endeavor. This was the 1951 or thereabouts. 5 years later, with Soviet help, using unspent rubles with UNESCO, the Indian Institute at Mumbai was established, at which point the Americans revised their earlier assessment and set up a consortium of 20 top American universities to help build the IIT at Kanpur. While UNESCO had played a catalytic role, the government of India, through bilateral programs with the erstwhile USSR, the erstwhile FRG, USA, and the UK, went on to build its first generation IITs. These institutes were modeled in more than one way on the American system. But as John Creek points out, the Americanization of higher education was accompanied by the internationalization of American education. By the late 1990s, American universities and Silicon Valley were swamped with students and engineers from the IITs and many of the nations in East Asia. On similar lines, one could provide a credible account of India's nuclear and space research programs. Here too, the parallelogram of forces needs to be drawn upon in order to resolve the tensions between an internationalism that facilitated the sharing of knowledge and technological know-how and the Cold War that resulted in the strategic reorganization of the regimes of knowledge production in many countries. The arms race unleashed by the Cold War convinced many developing countries as well to strategically reorganize and develop linkages between industry and the military, each one constructing its own version of a military-industry complex. The massification of the university was also triggered by the post-World War II consensus regarding the salience of scientific and technological development for the economy and the objectives of nation building. India's investment in higher education, rather than mass literacy and education, dates back to these years, a policy for which it was retrospectively criticized. But this does not mean that special attention was paid to the establishment of a large number of universities. Strategic sectors were carved out for special attention by the scientific establishment and policymakers, and elite research institutes and national laboratories were set up that were dedicated to the tasks mandated for them. These special research institutes were outside the framework of university science, but nevertheless depended upon them for their supply of bright students. It makes sense to argue that these three global processes played a major role in the post-colonial world in structuring the production of scientific knowledge and technological innovation. The massification of the university contributed to the bank of human resources that would be mobilized into developing scientific and technological capabilities. By the late 1980s, India had in sheer numbers the largest scientific manpower in the world. Whether it could meet their aspirations is another question. But there were developed countries where enrollments in science and technology began to decline in the 1990s. And India became one of the many destinations where universities and institutions in the developed world were shopping for students. The second wave of decolonization that commences in the 1950s entailed, on the one hand, ensuring that not only sovereignty of the new nation, but scientific and technological self-reliance, lest the nation lapse back into a state of neocolonialism. If leapfrogging was seen as one of the strategies for fast-tracking scientific development, the other entailed the objectives of the institutions of colonial science, that the institutions of colonial science be reoriented towards the needs of the new nation rather than to close down the institutions of colonial science. So the Cold War necessitated enrolling science and technology in the economic and strategic interests of the nations, while India attempted to maintain a benign non-alignment through the decades and capitalized on this neutrality to the extent that it could develop its capabilities in strategic sectors. In this sense, there is some continuity with the past. Though the 1930s and after, the commitment to non-alignment and the long-distance collegial ties its leading scientists had forged with their colleagues on both sides of the Iron Curtain proved beneficial and were survivals of the internationalism that predated the new regimes. Though the field was always politically ideological and ideologically mined, the older institutional differentiation that divided the world of science and technology into metropolis and province, center and periphery, persisted with minor changes in dynamics and cartography. The Japanese historian of science, Shigeru Nakayama, had reminded us en route that the center always shifts. Nevertheless, scientometric studies revealed how these centers and peripheries continued to operate. So far, my discussion has related to what happens in the realm of big science and high tech. In fact, the success of the Manhattan Project transformed it into a model for the pursuit of big science and mission-oriented research. Not much. I have not said anything about the digital revolution or mega science, which are important developments of the 21st century. So, towards the end of the talk, rather than wind up the various strands towards the conclusion, I discuss a new problem area colleagues and I have ventured into, namely the scientific activities or what are referred to as the people science movements in India. The stimulus came from the study of the history of a biogas research program pursued at the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore, a piece of work I commenced with a trained microbiologist, but also partially inspired by my friend Denis Vidal here, who went on to edit a special issue of Technique et Culture called High Tech, Low Tech, Why Tech. So, and although the scientists who were pursuing this research on biogas within institutions of big science, whether it was in England or whether it was in India or elsewhere, in the field, what we witnessed so many temporalities and so many ways that intersected with each other that we began to find it difficult to maintain the high tech, low tech distinction Denis was trying to emphasize. Over the years, we find that what is at stake is how we conceptualize technology, which takes us back to the beginning of this talk, and that we need to work with an end-use conception of technological development. On doing so, we see routes of circulation and exchange of biogas research that traverse Bombay, England, countries in Africa, France, or to name just a few. And in every case, improvisation and innovations are not just stimulated at the centers of science, but within local contexts and know-hows, but more importantly, by different end users. Gradually, we were drawn into a neighboring project involving a group of researchers studying the relationship between state science and civil society organizations between 1970 and 2000, a period of some remarkable experiments on science and its democratization in India. Naturally, as students of science primarily and society, we needed to position our own study within this larger concern. We soon realized that the appropriate technology movement has been little studied in India or abroad, and in a way, understandably so. It doesn't quite have the sex appeal that big science does. This is, however, in contrast to its contemporary importance, its importance today. Many of the contemporary efforts with non-conventional or renewable energy sources commenced in many parts of the world in small research programs. We would like to call it small science with big impact. This became our point of departure. This was indeed small science that made a significant impact in rural areas in India, a small science that has traversed many fields and sub-disciplines of the sciences and engineering. Very often, innovation in these areas has certainly not been market-driven. As a result, the sociologist of technology, Vibhav Baikar, recently coined the term socially responsible innovation. In the history of these programs, we encounter debates, cautionary voices, and trenchant criticism of the emerging technological boom of the post-World War II years, otherwise marked largely by techno-optimism and evangelism. I am not just referring to the dystopias alluded to earlier, but even in the writings of tragic Faustian figures such as Oppenheimer and von Neumann, who balked at the horrifying dimensions of the new sciences. To these, one must add the building Carsonian crescendo of the 1960s and the neo-Gandhians and eco-feminists of the 1970s and 1980s that mounted a critique of science and technology. These critiques reshaped the contours and practices of what came to be referred to as alternative technology. These stories have much to tell us where we happen to be going today. The important question is, why have not historians of science been our storytellers or historians of technology? Are the histories of these sciences and these techniques not worth telling? The history of science and technology in South Asia has been preoccupied with the production of knowledge and is epistemically or institutionally ensconced within the paradigm of big science and high tech. The innovation and improvisation that goes on at the grassroots, the interstices of social movements, civil society organizations, and scientific networks have remained outside its purview. And here, there are stories to tell, not so much about empire, which we shall relate in any case as part of our vocation for struggle, but in this case, after empire, more perhaps about science and connected livelihoods. Science for a sustainable world. Science in the Anthropocene. For all his faith in the transformative potential of modern science, Nehru knew full well that the monster that science had created had run amok. The period between 1940s and 60s would be interesting. It would be interesting to study the imaginaries of the new science and technology, reflecting the anxieties, fears, and uncertainties, its disruptive possibilities, rather than just its transformative potential. Beyond the cautionary tale and historical interest, this might open up the possibility of reshaping science. The behavioral psychologist Skinner pointed out that this was in 1955, that the crucial fear was that if science had its way, human beings would lose their ability to think. I think we historians of science have been preoccupied with the optimism and transformative possibilities, which till 50 years was all but visible. Today, at the edge of a new technological regime called AI, we reckon with the same fears that have persisted for long. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.